Good morning. I'm your host, Claudia Shambaugh, welcoming you to the January 31, 2017 edition of Ask a Leader. Today, I'm going to dedicate this Ask a Leader to those who are in limbo in too many levels all around the world. These people, they've hitched their wagons to the security of a better life, a settled life in the heterogeneous and democratic society that is the U.S. It's the last day to apply for health insurance in the Affordable Care Act, the coverage which would last until the end of this year, 2017. Today, UCI law professor, insanely busy blogger and Twitter, and a very present on all these other media platforms is Rick Hassan. He's gracing our airwaves once again to talk about voting rights and 2016 electoral outcomes. If those trends keep you up at night, our next guest, Dr. Ruth Benka, professor chair of UCI's Department of Psychiatry and Human Behavior, will offer important insight about sleep hygiene. Along the way, she'll present some very cool aspects about the sleeping brain that you probably hadn't considered. Psst, all critters sleep. We'll be right back after a short station break. Welcome back to the show. My first guest is Rick Hassan, the Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at UCI. Rick Hassan is nationally recognized expert in election law and campaign finance regulation and is the co-author of a leading casebook on election law. In 2013, he was named one of the most 100 influential lawyers in America by the National Law Journal. You may have already heard him on NPR or seen his recent editorials in the New York Times, Washington Post, LA Times, and elsewhere. He also writes the oft-quoted election law blog. Among his books are selections that bob and weave between a lawyerly following and a mainstream reading, including The Voting Wars from Florida to the Next Election Meltdown. We're gonna watch it melt here today. And a year ago, he appeared on this show to discuss Plutocrats United, Campaign Money, the Supreme Court, and the Distortion of American Elections, published by Yale University Press. And so we're bringing him back on. His appointments at UCI School of Law faculty, and he's also faculty member of the UC Irvine Center for the Study of Democracy. Welcome back to Ask a Leader, Professor Rick Hassan.
Nice to be with you.
Since we last talked about a year ago when your Plutocrats United was released, a few developments warrant your commentary, your careful attention. We're so privileged to have you here. Well, what commands your attention most? This is January 31, 2017.
Well, we're expecting at some point today.
Tonight, I guess.
To get a Supreme Court name nomination from President Trump. And I've been following the nomination process very closely over the last decade or so. And I think this is going to be a pivotal moment for Democrats to decide how much at all they're going to try to obstruct the nomination in light of the Republicans' refusal to give even a hearing to President Obama's nominee for that seat, Merrick Garland, or if the Democrats are going to hold their fire, which it sounds like they're at least considering doing, and waiting for the next Supreme Court nomination, should one come during a Trump administration, to really make a stand, because if that other nomination is someone like Justice Ginsburg, who is the oldest member of the court, or Justice Kennedy, who is the swing member of the court, it really could have the potential to move the court much further to the right than it was when Justice Scalia was still on the court until his death last February.
Understood. What do you understand is the manner in which the sitting Supreme Court justices watching the nomination process? Are they mindful of where winds are blowing? With Anthony Kennedy, you know, sort of on the fence, could go either way with the rulings. What do those sitting Supreme Court justices, how closely do they follow what's going on?
I think, you know, they have been directly impacted by the death of Justice Scalia, which has caused the court to deadlock in a series of cases, 4-4, for more liberal justices, all appointed by Democratic presidents, 4 more conservative justices, all appointed by Republican presidents. And so not only have there been some cases where they probably would have taken the case had there been a majority one way or the other, but also they've decided some cases in ways that really put issues off for another day. It's very hard for them to make decisions in these higher profile cases without a ninth justice. And so assuming we get a justice confirmed, which I think is the most likely scenario, that within the next, say, 3 or 4 months, we do get a Trump nominee confirmed, then things should look a lot like the way they looked when Justice Scalia was still alive, meaning
right.
a mostly conservative court, but with Justice Kennedy, the swing justice on issues where, for example, he could keep the court in the center or to the left on issues such as gay rights, abortion, and some other issues. But, of course, on many other issues, he's been a reliable conservative. So it's going to be really back to mostly the way it was when Scalia was on the court. Although I should point out that Justice Scalia had some interesting positions on certain criminal justice issues, positions for which even Merrick Garland, had he been appointed the President Obama nominee, could
yes.
have moved the court to the right on those questions. So it's too early to know for sure, but I think that's the way things are looking right now.
Okay, and so there isn't anything in particular that what the Democrats would do in either keeping their powder dry or obstructing this that would signal anything to the swing vote on the Supreme Court?
Well, no, I don't think so. I mean, I think the real issue is that you talked about Justice Kennedy, and I think it's right to focus there.
Yes.
On questions of executive power and on obeying the courts, those are issues where Justice Kennedy is probably looking less at who the Supreme Court nominee is going to be and more on whether Trump's actions comport with the rule of law. And I think that to the extent that Justice Kennedy believes that some of Trump's actions on, say, the executive orders or things that are likely to come down the pike are an executive overreach, he could be a justice that could be convinced. And this may apply, depending on what happens, to Chief Justice Roberts as well, as someone who's not willing to necessarily toe a party or ideological line and would be interested in reining in executive overreach by the Trump administration.
The one of the author's names I'm just trying to find escapes me, but John, he was a co-author with John Yoo with an editorial in the Washington Post yesterday about...
Kai Prakash.
Okay, thank you. And so I don't know if you wanted to comment on their corner on the constitutional interpretation market.
Well, there was one interesting line
yes.
in that op-ed in the Los Angeles Times, I think it was on Sunday, which said that Trump should resist the urge to appoint a justice who would focus on, quote, justice or fairness, that constitutional law has nothing to do with those things. And it's just a very different view of the job of a judge or a justice than the view that I have, which is that whether you're liberal or conservative, one of the jobs of the Supreme Court justice is to do justice. And there are so many provisions of the Constitution, and I think even Justice Scalia would have admitted this, where there must be interpretation, where the words do not define themselves. Take the words due process or equal protection. They do not define themselves, even if they have an original meaning, and that's what we want to look at. When you're deciding in close cases what that means, of course we should be considering what is the just and fair thing to do. And so I think that is an ideological battle. I don't think that President Trump is thinking about things in those terms. He wants a pick that is going to please and consolidate the
base.
Conservative Republicans who supported him over Hillary Clinton, but who are wary of some of the both his what he would do as a matter of policy, as well as his personal history. And so they have been wary of him. But I think this is the most important issue to many of them, which is a reliable conservative on the Supreme Court. And on that, the choice between Judge Gorsuch and Judge Hardiman, what I'm hearing is that Gorsuch would be a more reliable conservative vote.
You're and not so, concluding Mr. Pryor in this?
Well,
he's not like a contender?
He seems to have fallen out of favor for one reason or
okay.
another, at least according to the rumors that we've been hearing. I think Gorsuch would be a safer pick for Trump to make in terms of pleasing the Republican base. I think there are more questions about Hardiman, who has been a bit more circumspect in his judicial opinions. And I should say that Pryor, there have been some on the right who have criticized Pryor. I think Gorsuch is the safe way to go. I don't know. I have no idea what Trump is going to do. For all we know, it could be Ted Cruz that he names. I just really have no idea. But I think the safe choice, if what you're trying to do is please the conservative Republican base, would be to choose Gorsuch. We'll see. Maybe tonight, if it actually happens.
Tonight. That's East Coast time, so it'll probably be sometime like late afternoon for us at some point.
I'll be teaching my torts class. Commenting immediately.
You will. We'll see. Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll watch later on. Well, for those of you just tuned in, my guest is UCI Law Professor Rick Hassan. It's all about voting rights, folks. We're moving into that. There's a lot to say about what happened with the general election. We'll try to deconstruct some of the outcomes. The one man, one vote principle certainly took a few hits with the congressional outcomes, with state assembly districts that were representing more, there were more Democratic votes cast, but many fewer districts that they won in. What about the one man, one vote principle here?
Well, remember, the one person, one vote principle applies to districting generally, and it does not apply to our presidential election, right? We don't treat all votes equally.
We don't.
We have an electoral college, which gives advantage to the smaller states, even with California's population being many, many times greater than, say, Montana's or Wyoming. It is disproportionate. Same way in the Congress, it works that way. But even within states, where states have to comply with the one-person, one-vote principle, which says essentially that you have to draw districts for congressional districts with the same number of people in them, and for state and local districts with pretty much with some leeway, the same number of people in them. Even given that parameter, it is possible to draw districts to help one party or the other. And what we've seen is that, especially because legislatures tend to be dominated by Republicans around the country these days, we're seeing a lot of claims that Republicans have drawn the lines deliberately to minimize Democratic voting strength. And this is called partisan gerrymandering.
Right.
The Supreme Court so far has been unwilling to police it, but Justice Kennedy, who has been the swing vote on this issue, has said, even though I haven't found a standard to police it yet, keep coming back to me with new possible standards, and maybe I will choose to rein it in. And in fact, there are now at least three cases working their way up to the United States Supreme Court, which will likely, and the one that I'm watching the most closely, is coming out of Wisconsin.
Yes.
This case has now just been decided. Finally, we're waiting for last aspect of the case to be cleaned up. It has been. We expect the state of Wisconsin to appeal directly to the Supreme Court. It's coming up directly from a three-judge court. It's kind of an odd way that some cases get up to the Supreme Court, which makes it very likely the Supreme Court would hear the case. So we'd be looking at a potential hearing sometime in the next Supreme Court term, which starts in October. And by a year from June, we may have a ruling that, in fact, there are some times when state legislatures draw lines in such a way to help one political party and hurt the other that it violates the Constitution.
Do you anticipate that's a question that would be asked before in the nomination process here for the next Supreme Court justice?
Well,
I know it's a blatant.
It's something that people could bring up, but do think that I expect that whoever is nominated, and I would say the same thing if it were a Democrat who was nominated, that they would decline to answer specific questions. And it's kind of hard to know. Even if you're a hardcore conservative, you might not believe that this partisan gerrymandering is okay. It doesn't exactly break down along party and ideological lines. And so we have to wait and see what happens. But we know that the four liberals on the court are ready to start policing this. And Justice Kennedy has kept the door open. So even if the new justice, if we do get a new justice, would side with where Justice Scalia was, that these are cases that are non-justiciable, that the courts cannot decide them, that they present essentially political questions that are best left to the political process. Even if we, even if that justice takes that same position, there could still potentially be five justices to start reining this in.
So I often, I try to really be very discreet and practice some caution here in how many emails I send you when I'm going off the handles with voter suppression claims that I read about from time to time. What in the way of voter suppression was the most pernicious in what played out in 2016's general elections?
Well, I don't love the term voter suppression.
Okay.
Just because it's kind of like a slogan, and people will put anything into it, kind of like fake news.
All right, so
fraud.
What's the word you use, expression?
So if you're asking me what were the most significant limitations to people being able to register and vote in the 2016 election, I would say that what we've seen is a pattern since the mid-2000s and really accelerating over the last few years because of a couple of Supreme Court rulings, of Republican legislatures passing laws that have made it more difficult to register and vote, laws that impose strict voter identification requirements, limiting the early voting period, eliminating same-day voter registration, consolidating polling places, changing district lines. Lots of these things have been done in ways that were probably intended in many instances to make it harder for voters who are likely to vote for Democrats to register and vote. That said, it's not clear how much these laws actually have had this effect.
That's what you say. So
yes.
Unpackage that a little bit more as we're covering all
sure.
this.
Sure. So it's very tempting for Democrats looking for a reason to explain why Hillary Clinton lost to say, well, it must have been the voter identification law, for example. The strict laws must have been responsible. And we can look to a state like Wisconsin, which passed a strict law, which has been challenged, but yet is still mostly on the books. There was a little bit of softening by the courts. And so maybe that explains Wisconsin, although the best empirical evidence I've seen so far has not suggested that there were enough people who wanted to vote who weren't able to vote because they lacked ID and who would have voted for Clinton to actually change the outcome. But compare that to Pennsylvania, where
yes.
its voter ID law was held up in court for a number of years, and then the Pennsylvania abandoned it. And so Pennsylvania does not have a strict voter ID law, and yet Clinton lost by many thousands more votes in Pennsylvania. So I think the Democrats point to voter suppression at their peril as the reason for their loss. It's certainly true that some of these laws have been put in place to make it harder for Democrats to vote, but it's not clear from the empirical evidence that they've actually had a large effect. I also think that asks the wrong question.
Okay.
The question we should be asking is not, did these laws affect turnout or affect election outcomes? The question we should be asking as a legal matter anyway is, why is the state making it harder for people to register and vote if they have no good
okay.
reason to do so? And it turns out these laws do not appear to do anything to prevent voter fraud or promote voter confidence, which are the two reasons usually put forward for why these laws are put on the books. They instead seem to be motivated by a desire to gain partisan advantage. And I think what I'd like to see is courts get in the business of policing this much better and saying that states should not be able to make it harder to register and vote unless there is some good reason to do so.
Well, one part of the when you're talking about consolidating polling places, that I was particularly taken by was that with long lines and discouraging voters, that there's that's the outcome in that election, but it will discourage voters was the sort of political psychology. It discourages voters from voting in the future, that can have a pernicious effect.
Yes, but I also think that the laws can have a backlash effect. This doesn't justify them, but in fact, what we see
okay.
is that Democrats campaign against voter suppression. They use, you know, they use that term a lot, and they claim that Republicans are trying to prevent them from voting. Just like Republicans campaign and say, "Oh, come on, you need to come out and vote and cancel out that Democratic voter fraud. And so that these things actually motivate voters to vote and give money and do all kinds of things. They serve a kind of political purpose in addition to directly potentially affecting the election.
The bloody shirt, as it were. There. Well, you mentioned voter fraud, and I guess there's comic relief in this, and that the same guy behind True the Vote, Greg Phillips, is also registered in three different states, and it's a double standard, of course. The people that are claiming fraud, that they're not concerned about some of these clerical problems of their own, but I'm concerned, Rick Hassan, about this voter fraud campaign is a distraction, a rabbit hole to pull people in to divert attention away from consequential policy being made. Is that your sense?
Well, no. I mean, I think that Trump has made a series of false claims,
yeah,
which are completely unsupported by the evidence about the extent to which there have been non-citizen voters and other illegal voters in the election, claiming without evidence and citing completely unsupported statements of Greg Phillips that 3 to 5 million illegal votes were cast in the election. I think it is likely going to lead to a sham investigation into these questions, which will then be the predicate for trying to introduce national legislation to make it harder to register and vote, things like national voter ID, getting rid of parts of the 1993 National Voter Registration Act, the motor voter law, which requires states to offer voter registration materials in places that offer public assistance and in departments of motor vehicles, etc. And so I think it can serve as the predicate for something that is significant. The other thing I would say is that people are paying attention, and so I don't know that I would call things a distraction. I think that people are on the left are energized in a way that I've not seen before, or at least not in recent decades. And I think that there will be plenty of attention paid to this issue if Trump actually goes down this road with still enough energy to be paid to other things that might happen.
Well, I appreciate your giving us the heads up to watch that national legislating of various voter requirements, which is, it's been a very decentralized administration of policy. So this, thanks for the heads up there. Well, what are you following in the Jeff Sessions Attorney General confirmation process?
Well, I think Sessions is going to get through, unlike some of the other hearings we've just heard about this morning.
Right.
The Mnuchin hearing and the Price hearing, where Democrats have boycotted the hearing, thereby depriving the committees of a quorum vote and potentially slowing down or even stopping these nominations. I think Sessions is going to get confirmed. I think the Democrats are going to vote against him. They're not going to filibuster his nomination, and he will be the Attorney General. I think that's very bad news in terms of voting rights, in terms of civil rights, for reasons lots of people have put forward. But I don't think they're going to make their stand against one of their own sitting senators. I think the stand is going to be elsewhere. He is going to come in, and he is going to clean house, and he is going to fundamentally flip the position of the Department of Justice on a number of issues where the Obama administration was on one side. And in the areas that I follow, on the questions of voter identification laws and strict voting rules, there are cases from both Texas and North Carolina that are working their way through the courts.
Right.
And I expect him to flip the position 180 degrees in those cases, which could potentially have some effect on not only these cases, but on other Republican legislatures being willing to, in various states, being willing to adopt similar laws.
As we race through here, near the conclusion, that the campaign on the campaign finance front, the meaning and the likely outcome of it's the Koch brothers, their PAC, the Americans for Prosperity Foundation versus Becerra. What do you see the outcome might be there?
Well, so the question that is not just in that case, but in a number of other cases that is working its way through the courts is the extent to which disclosure laws are onerous and preventing people from engaging in political activities. It's a way to try to not only spend unlimited sums to influence elections and policy, but to do so without the public knowing who's spending the money.
The lack of transparency.
And I think that, you know, the So far, the Supreme Court has held the line, and I should say Justice Scalia was one of the justices who was a great believer in campaign finance disclosure. He said that people should have civic courage. They should stand up for what they believe in. We'll see if the court thinks that some of these newer laws, which require disclosure not just by campaign organizations, but by certain nonprofits that have, say, filed under the Internal Revenue Code 501c4, need to disclose their information to not necessarily to the public, but to state officials such as the Attorney General, and that's what's at issue in that Americans for Prosperity case.
And Eric Holder has launched a National Democratic Redistricting Committee. Do you hold out any promise that this might have some kind of benefit in the status quo here?
Well, to the extent to which the Democrats under Holder and Obama are going to try to organize and recapture state legislatures and control the districting process, then that would be a political benefit, and then Democrats could engage in the same partisan gerrymandering that Republicans are. But to the extent that we're talking about affecting legal change, I think that there are plenty of others that are already in that business, and it's really going to be up to Justice Kennedy and the Supreme Court when the issues make their way back there in the next year.
That gives us a good playbook to follow the unfolding events. I really appreciate Rick Hassan for you coming on back on the show. I want to remind everybody that there's still copies available. They've got to be at the Ann Hill Bookstore or your favorite independent book dealer online. You can get the Plutocrats United. It's quite a read, and Rick Hassan made sure we could all follow it and understand it. So I've got hats off to everybody at the law school is all hands on deck, following all the executive orders, the confirmation hearings, the posturing in the national and state legislatures. You're all hands on deck. I really laud you for deep involvement and penetrating the media to make sure we're all keeping track of what's so consequential. Rick Hassan, UCI law professor, thank you again for being on the show today.
Thank you. Take care.
Okay, you too. I'll be right back with Dr. Ruth Benka. For those of you who were wondering about you're going to get your sleep, well, she's going to talk about sleep hygiene and sleep health. We'll be right back after a short station break.
How did we survive this heart attack? We left our daggers in each other's backs. Every soldier needs a strategy. But I can't beat you because you're just like me.
That was Omar Torres, and that was Who's Gonna Pay for That Door? Welcome back to the show. We have on Dr. Ruth Benka, Chair of Psychiatry and Human Behavior at UC Irvine Health. She is an expert in sleep medicine, the topic on which she will speak next Tuesday at the Irvine Barclay Theater. She leads the department's academic research and clinical efforts as she plans to build a state-of-the-art academic sleep medicine center, which will pursue research and patient treatments for sleep problems and related neuropsychiatric issues. Dr. Benka came to UCI just last spring after 24 years at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where she served as director of the University of Wisconsin Center for Sleep Medicine and Sleep Research, and as the medical director for Wisconsin Sleep, where she treated patients with a broad range of sleep disorders. Widely published in her field, Dr. Benka is an internationally recognized authority on the relationship between sleep and psychiatric disorders, and she served as a principal investigator for a number of basic and clinical research studies funded by agencies including the National Institutes of Health and the Department of Defense. She served as president of the Sleep Research Society and on the board of the American Academy of Sleep Medicine. She completed her undergraduate degree at Harvard University, her MD and PhD at the University of Chicago Pritzker School of Medicine, and both her residency and fellowship at the University of Chicago. She's put in extensive appearances on public radio. Happily, we have her here on ours. She has so much to tell us about brain health and all the trains that it drives, all the while setting aside her important points that she'll deliver at next week's talk. What we don't cover today will resume later as she establishes UCI's sleep research program. She joins me in studio. Welcome to Ask a Leader, Dr. Ruth Benka.
Thank you so much for having me today.
All right. Why is sleep so important?
Oh, that's the really big question. Sleep is a really fascinating behavior because we spend more time sleeping than doing just about anything else. And yet, until fairly recently, we were pretty clueless as to why we needed to sleep. We now are starting to understand that sleep has many, many important functions, in particular for brain health and brain function and learning and memory. But it also has impacts on physical health as well. So sleep is primarily important for the brain, but it's important for the rest of the body as well.
Birds do it. Bees do it. Even educated fruit flies do it.
Yes.
And that, folks, is sleep. Dr. Benka, tell us about the extent that all creatures tuck in and the differences and how you know all this stuff.
Well, that's actually one of the great things about sleep. Every animal that has ever been studied appears to sleep. Basically, anything that has a brain or neurons, in fact, sleep. So sleep is something that is important for the health of neurons. So we know that all mammals sleep. Interestingly, both mammals and birds, which are both warm-blooded animals, have both what we call non-rapid eye movement and rapid eye movement sleep, meaning dreaming sleep and non-dreaming sleep. The other creatures that have been studied, including reptiles and amphibians and insects and even worms, appear to have less differentiated sleep, but in fact they do sleep. And we know they sleep partly because we can distinguish sleep by how a creature behaves, but we can also record neuronal activity and see classic patterns of sleep in all creatures that have been studied.
That when you told me that in preparation, I just thought that was the coolest, revelation
yeah.
here. Well, now, looking at sleep as a kind of drug of choice, let's talk about how fundamental sleep is to our physical and our mental health.
Well, we all are pretty aware of this because I'm sure everybody has had an occasional night when you don't sleep well or you don't get enough sleep and you don't feel good the next day. You also have problems perhaps staying awake when you're in a low stimulus situation, like sitting at your desk at work, sitting in class, at a meeting, or driving your car very dangerously. So we know that acutely, if we don't get enough sleep, we're not functioning well, mostly because we're really sleepy. But we now have overwhelming evidence from epidemiologic studies that people who don't sleep sufficiently for prolonged periods of time have a lot of health problems. People with chronic insomnia seem to have higher rates of disorders such as high blood pressure, diabetes. We know that there is increased mortality, greater risk of dying if you have problems with sleep. And we are now learning that common other sleep disorders, particularly sleep apnea, which is a problem in which people will repetitively stop breathing during their sleep. It's usually associated with loud snoring, can lead to many health problems, including cardiovascular disease, increased risks of strokes.
It's a marker for that then to pursue?
Yes.
Okay.
And now we're even learning that it increases cancer death.
Oh, wow. Has that been known for very long?
That's a pretty recent finding, and we think it's because the tumors grow better when they are deprived of oxygen.
Okay, wow. So would you talk about, are there differences between ages and gender and how much and type of sleep is needed? Because we hear a lot of myths about, well, you know, it doesn't matter how old you are. And the older you are, you don't really need it. But that's a myth.
Well, sleep is really interesting because it changes across our lives in relation to interesting changes that are going on in the brain. So young children need a lot of sleep as their brains are developing. Even adolescents need more sleep than adults, although they usually are getting less because they're staying up late at night and they're getting up early for school. As we go through adulthood and we get older, we do tend to sleep less. I think anybody that is, you know, over the age of 40 or 50 kind of remembers back to when you were younger and could easily sleep until noon on the weekend, and that's becomes much more difficult as we get older.
Or impossible.
Or impossible, yes. That might not necessarily be a bad thing. One of the things that happens as we get older is that we have higher rates of sleep disorders. Our brains change in a way that maybe doesn't support sleep as well. So it's still kind of a question, I think, for sleep scientists as to whether we truly need less sleep as we get older, or whether we just can't sleep as well as we get older. I suspect it's a little bit of both, that we probably don't need quite as much sleep as we get older. And some of the evidence in support of that is that it's actually older people do better with sleep loss than younger people do.
Oh, that is the truth.
In terms of how they function the next day.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Oh. So how do we adapt amidst the daily clock, the seasonal changes and jet lag? How does that work, our adapting?
Well, that's...
As you pointed out, that we don't have as many radical season changes, mm-hmm. but we still have the daylight savings will change, and yep. there's mm-hmm. different lengths of daylight hours.
Well, that gets into thinking about the two mechanisms that control our sleep patterns. So one thing that affects how much we sleep is how long we've been awake. And the human brain, and actually most species that have been studied in terms of looking at certain kinds of sleep deprivation effects, after about 16 hours of continuous wakefulness, humans don't function as well. And that's sort of gets into
16.
So we sleep about a third of the time and we're awake about two thirds of the time. Now those proportions vary across different species, but that's sort of the average for humans. Children may sleep half the time, younger children. And as we get older, we may cut those hours down a little bit. And one of the things that drives us to sleep is being awake. And that's why for people who have sleep problems, if they sleep in the morning to catch a little bit more sleep because they were up all night, it's going to make it even harder to get to bed at their desired bedtime the next day because they won't have been awake long enough.
As does a nap.
Right. And a nap can interfere if people have trouble sleeping at night.
Right.
Now, the other thing that controls our sleep patterns is our internal clock or circadian rhythm, and is really set by the light-dark cycle. The fact that all life on Earth has to adapt or deal with the fact that we go through predictable periods of light and dark, and we have to organize our behavior and physiology around that. And we survive better if we can kind of anticipate it's going to be night or it's going to be day. And that's what our clock helps us do. It helps us go through all the physiologic changes we need to do to adapt to whether we're going to be active and out and about during the day, or we're going to be resting at night. So the light-dark cycle actually plays a really important role in governing not only our daily sleep behavior, but also seasonal changes. And we see this much more in animals such as birds or hibernating mammals, that when the day length becomes very short in the winter, we'll be spending more time in sleep or sleep-like states. And even we do that. I mean, I think even in Southern California here, most people probably spend a few more minutes sleeping or even longer in bed during the winter months when the nights are long than they do in the summer when, you know, it's bright and sunny, you know, by 6 a.m.
Okay. For those of you who've just tuned in, you're listening to Ask a Leader on Radio KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, streaming on the web, KUCI.org. We're on Twitter, Facebook. We're on all the platforms. My guest is Dr. Ruth Benka, an internationally recognized authority on the relationship between sleep and psychiatric disorders. She's building a leading-edge sleep research center here at UCI. So I think it's fascinating. In preparation, you were telling me a little bit about what's involved. If you could talk at length a bit about that, describe how we shut down, how that brain, the whole globe and all the lobes shut down when we go to rest.
Well, that's another thing that I think people don't fully realize about sleep. It's not an instantaneous process. We don't sort of shut off at night, and we don't suddenly wake up in the morning sort of like flicking a switch. There are a number of systems in our brains that keep us awake during the day, and there are actually multiple systems in the brain that put us to sleep and keep us asleep during the night. And so it is a process to go to sleep at night, and we have to shut down our kind of waking behaviors and systems while the sleep systems can slowly start to take over. And that's why you need to actually plan for that. I always recommend that people should have at least a half hour, an hour before bedtime where they can simply relax and let go of all the stresses from the day so that their alerting systems can start to wind down. And similarly, when we fall asleep at night, and you never really fully remember the moment you fall asleep because it is sort of a gradual process, and we can't remember things that have happened within a few minutes of us truly falling asleep. The brain...
Because of that lobe that's not as active.
Well, yeah, and it's sort of sleep starts from the front and spreads to the back of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes about 8 to 12 minutes to fully fall asleep. And then as we get, start to fall asleep, we at the beginning of the night, we go into deeper and deeper stages of sleep. And that is a process that takes some time. And across the night, we cycle back and forth between different stages of sleep. And that cycling process and being able to stay asleep for periods of hours seems to be what's very important for the brain to do what it needs to do at night to achieve the functions of sleep, which are... Multiple. Yeah.
So the conditions and timing and the phasing of mm-hmm. activities that best accommodate it. You talked a little bit about mm-hmm. that, but like with the reading material, I think I probably offend these important principles. We should leave the editorial section. We should put that away at least an hour before. We should not be picking up on the articles we didn't read earlier in the day. We should be moving either into the comic strips or some sort of pleasant coffee table read.
Yes. Or
or no reading at all.
A lot of people like to do various kinds of relaxation techniques, meditation, yoga, something that calms you down before bed. You shouldn't do things that are going to stress you right before bed. But I think, the other thing to keep in mind is that sleeping well at night is not just about the things you do around bedtime and during the night. It really has a lot to do with what you do during the daytime as well. And so having a good structure to your day where you eat your meals at regular times, that you make sure you get exposed to some sunshine, ideally towards the middle of the day, that you have physical activity and exercise, all of those things are really important, not only for your health in general, but for good sleep health at night.
Wow. The whole day we ought to be thinking about this.
Right.
So everybody, start your outlines, not your engines then. Okay. Well, we hear a lot about pills that mm-hmm. help us sleep or stay awake. Do any of these allow us to get along with less sleep?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. And I think that this is the struggle that, people have been facing for probably centuries, is that, we spend so much time sleeping, and a lot of people feel it's a waste of time. Why should I spend my life in bed? Sort of the famous Warren Zevon quote, I'll sleep when I die.
Yeah.
We have better things to do with our time. And as a society, we are pretty sleep deprived. So the question is, well, how can we make up for that? Well, one of the most highly traded commodities in the world, of course, is coffee or caffeinated beverages.
Caffeine.
Yeah, so we drink a lot of caffeine. There's an increasing use of stimulant medications to help us stay awake. We use medications to help us fall asleep at night. And, you know, if we can optimize our sleep, maybe we can get away with less. And the fact is that up until now, we have not really discovered a substitute for sleep. We can take medications or use substances that keep us awake, but they don't really replace the role of sleep. They keep you awake, but the important brain functions that need to be achieved by sleep are not met. And they those included behavioral changes. A number of years ago, we did some studies in rats where we sleep deprived them. And a sleep deprived rat will behave kind of like a sleep deprived human. They get a bit hyperactive and they may have a lot of judgment problems. They don't respond to threatening situations the way they should. They misjudge them and don't realize they're as dangerous as they are. They become more risk-taking. Humans will do that too. And when we gave the rats stimulants to keep them awake.
What do they do?
Well, they stayed awake, but it didn't change their
behavior. They still made dumb decisions.
So that's an important thing to keep in mind. There is no replacement for sleep as of yet.
So all of you high-performing office workers who think that you're on the amphetamine of choice that you're using, there is a sort of calamity down the road, mm-hmm. that their brains aren't shedding what they need to shed in that sleep, and they're headed toward, and you'll talk about dementia and all that later, but
yes.
This is a real deficit they're running in brain health now with using those substances.
Yeah, and I think in the short run, you know, people feel like they're more efficient and they can accomplish more. But another thing is that, and anybody who's done this probably notices this, you can stay up late trying to get something done, but you're really not efficient. And so the best thing is go to sleep, get some sleep, and you'll get those jobs done or those problems solved a lot quicker and more efficiently if you're rested, because your brain is going to work better.
Well, let's go through what the various sort of tips for mm-hmm. various demographics of patterns and all that. So we'll address them in our daily living. For the students, Dr. Benka, what do you have to say about the students who pull their next all-nighter? What do you tell them?
Well,
speaking of those little naps.
Yeah, we recommend that you shouldn't pull all-nighters. You're not going to really learn efficiently. And in fact, one of the functions of sleep is to consolidate certain types of learning. So you're going to learn more complex tasks better and certain kinds of tasks better if you can sleep after a period of learning. Students, particularly our college age students, still need a lot of sleep, probably at least 8 or 9 hours a night for most of them. Some sleep is always better than no sleep. I know that oftentimes young people feel like, well, if I'm going to pull an all-nighter, it's better to just stay up all night and tough through it. Actually, any sleep is better than no sleep. Even now, long-haul pilots flying, you know, transcontinentally will take naps on their long flights and not try to pull an all-nighter. So sleep is always good for you.
Okay. And the next group, for teenagers who liked that 2 p.m. wake-up time on weekends mm-hmm. and have to return to the bell schedule for the following Monday. What do you have to
tell
them?
Well, yeah, we call that social jet lag. You know, you're living in a completely different time zone on the weekends than you are during the week. And that's very challenging. And there have studies been done that have shown that teenagers who have these very dramatic shifts in their sleep amount and their sleep timings between weekdays and weekends don't do as well in school, and they have more problems with depression and other types of psychological issues.
Okay, and then the next group, parents. For mm-hmm. the parents, they're not sure how to be about how much and when screen time.
Well, it's not just screen time, but it's, you know, the cell phones and the...
That's a screen, I still call it.
Oh, yeah. Okay. All those gadgets. So it turns out that the more screen time the parents have, the more screen time the children have. So this is not just a problem of teenagers anymore. It's a family-wide problem. And both parents and teenagers who spend too much time on the screen late at night are shortchanging themselves of sleep. They actually sleep less. So we really advise keeping all screens out of the bedrooms.
Because all that high performing they're interested in mm-hmm. for their children, they're not going to consolidate their learning
right.
with that deferred mm-hmm. and diminished rest. Well, when is it time for us to consult with a professional? We got to wrap here.
Yeah, so if you're feeling like your sleep is not restorative, or you have trouble sleeping at night, or you have trouble staying awake during the day, or you do things at night which are abnormal, like, you know, walking in your sleep or moving in your sleep or snoring loudly that might suggest sleep apnea, the first thing to do is to check with your primary care provider. Make sure you're also scheduling enough time for sleep. And if needed, they can refer you to a sleep specialist if it's more than can be dealt with in your primary care provider's office.
So how, Dr. Banka, how well trained are primary care and other health care providers in dealing with sleeping disorders? Do they know what they're doing, or they're getting your bulletins sort of belatedly?
We're working hard on trying to educate all healthcare providers about the importance of sleep. I think, you know, one of the issues is that for many, many years, we didn't learn about sleep in medical school because we just learned about the time we're awake and our physiologic functions while we're awake. And it's only been in recent decades that we've learned that very dramatic things change not only in our brains but our bodies during the period of sleep that are very important for many medical disorders. So I think the word is spreading about the importance of sleep, and we're increasing the amount of education that goes on.
Well, I want to make sure everybody knows all about, you'll be talking next week at the Barclay Theater for the title of your talk next.
What Can We Learn from the Sleeping Brain?
And that is next Tuesday, mm-hmm. February 7th at the Barclay. It starts at 7:30. No tickets, no reservations are required. But
just show up.
Just do show up. But the fact that you're not required to pay or reserve does not take any value away. So it's a very, very important thing. And so what I wanted also to assure listeners is that, Dr. Banka, that for all of the material that we haven't been able to cover and for about what's going on at the Sleep Center, I hope that we'll have you on the show.
Look forward to that. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. That was Dr. Ruth Banka, and she is an internationally recognized sleep expert here.
Now it's time to say goodnight.
And she'll be back again. Well, that was my wrap. Next week, we'll hear from author Steve Early, out with a new book, Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of an American City. He offers promising news about the force or the impact of grassroots efforts, something we could all take consideration. Then we'll have on the new dean of UCI's New School of Nursing, Adi Nayamati. Talk with you next week. Thank you, everyone, for listening.